Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Thank you for listening to Kicking the Kyriarchy.
And that makes you pretty kick-ass.
We are an intersectional feminist podcast co-created by me, Sid.
And me, Elena. We really hope that you enjoyed the first episode last month, and as ever, we love to hear from you. So give us a rating on iTunes and visit our website.
You can call us out, be a guest, or suggest a topic at www.kickingthekyriarchy.org, or you can tweet us at kickkyriarchy.
So, for example, Sarah and Tom pointed out to us that it's better to say non-disabled than able or able-bodied when describing the absence of a disability.
And Helen got in touch because she really liked the podcast content and tone, but would have liked it to touch on privilege by virtue of age, which, actually, we should probably devote an entire episode to.
And lastly, we had an anonymous comment that basically said that everyone has experienced discrimination, and discrimination can be far more complex than the issues that we touched on. And this is really valid, and it would have been great to have had a contact and a name so that we could get in contact, get more info and links to we can educate ourselves and share.
Thank you for getting in touch, because we're taking it all on board. We've had an overwhelmingly positive response from everyone who's listened, so thank you for taking the time to let us know. If you want to put this in the form of an iTunes review, that would be even better.
We're also working on getting some advertising so that we can help contribute to the costs in getting involved, so for example, getting to and from the studio.
So, after a pretty abstract topic like privilege, we're going to sink our teeth into beauty. Whilst we might disagree on how best to explain beauty, can we agree on beauty standards and how they affect us?
Sid and I are going to acknowledge right here and now that we are what you might call normatively pretty. So blonde hair,
blue eyes,
white skin,
and slim.
And but that's enough about us.
We're so badass. Yeah, we're just kicking your ass. Yeah.
Kick, kick, kick the karaoke. Kick, woo, kick woo. The karaoke. Ray, please introduce yourself.
Hi, so I'm Ray. I am a white, cisgendered, fat female, and I talk very loudly on the internet about being fat and being mentally ill and being disabled. I'm a big believer in being out there and being a role model for people, and I also run a personal blog, which I'm going to be turning into a professional blog, which mentors young people who are dealing with being fat or mentally ill or disabled or questioning their sexuality. Oh, I'm also bisexual. I forgot to mention that. So yeah, that's me.
That's brilliant. Can you tell us where we can find the blogs, or do you want to plug them?
So at the moment, you can find me on Twitter at OiRae, which is O-I-R-A-E. You can also request me on Instagram if you like seeing fat people and food, because there's plenty of that on there. And I'm in the process of making my formal blog, which will be launched through my Twitter very soon.
Exciting. We will definitely watch that platform.
Yes, we'll definitely share that on our Twitter when it's released and shared.
Fantastic.
What do beauty standards mean to you?
See, I always have in the back of my head beauty standards as being white, thin, and naturally thin. That's the other thing that always comes up for me, and often blonde. But it's a really cis female thin standard, which I think we're all held to. And I think it really affects, or has affected me, and I know it's affected a lot of people, in having this bizarre ideal in the back of your head, which is like a Frankenstein of yourself. You know, you hold yourself to a standard which is totally impossible and totally improbable. And that's what a beauty standard means to me. It's that thing of there's tons of magazines, there's tons of actresses, there's tons of singers that all kind of end up being the same thin white woman Right. And then you just sort of end up sticking your head on top.
I think that's probably a beauty standard that at least I can identify with, and I assume you too, Sid.
I think that's really, really well written. That totally is, isn't it? You pop your head on it.
So when did you become aware of beauty standards? Is there a particular age?
I hit puberty very young, so I got started to get treated like an adult when I was about 8 years old.
Wow, that's really young.
Yeah, it is really young. I'm 5'3" for the listeners, but I've been 5'3" since I was 9 years old. I had a growth spurt young. So people started to refer to me in a way which was very inappropriate, really. Like they really started to put those ideas in my head of what you should look like and stop treating me like a child. And because I had to wear adult clothes as well, because I was tall, it suddenly opened up this whole world of fashion to me, which was very scary. I mean, you know, it's one thing dressing up your dolls. It's another thing having to dress up yourself. So that's when I really started to become aware of it, and being aware that I wasn't like other children. And then you become aware that you're not really like the other teenagers. And as someone that's big in every way, it starts to make you feel othered.
I think what you're talking about there, when you're talking about puberty and the wider context of the world, is kind of that society ideal of what it means to be a woman, maybe.
Absolutely.
Can you touch a bit more about that? Because being eight and being told things like that in comments.
Yeah, that's the thing that I'm really shocked about, is the fact that when you think about being 8 years old, that's really, really young to have like such strong ideals and to be treated as like a woman.
Well, this is an interesting point, actually. It does lead very much into fat identity as well. People judge you on your looks. They judge you on what they see first off. They don't ask you anything about your life, about your circumstances. To those people, I was not an eight-year-old. The people on the street, they did not see an eight-year-old. They saw someone who might be 14, 15, 16. That really influences you, because you're always being taken to something you're not, and there's always assumptions being made about you. And having to learn that very young, I think everyone learns that eventually, but learning that at 8 or 9 years old is a really big marker. You will be judged on your appearance, and you can't change that. All you can really change is how much you care. Really. Right.
How do you think all of this shapes your identity now? So, for example, you're a fat activist, is that the word?
Yeah, I'd say that. Yeah. I'm very happy to be called fat. A massive part of that has been I was facing stuff which other people wasn't facing at that age, you know, like crushes on boys, really strong crushes on boys, and then later on crushes on girls. And I really sort of buried myself in food around that time.
So what is fat activism?
Fat activism covers quite a few things, but the main thing it covers is being out there in society, being able to call yourself fat, and accepting that that is your body shape right now. You might not be that forever, you might not be that in the past, but right now, in this moment, you're a fat person. And fat activism usually concerns itself with educating people. I'd say that attacking fat people is the last acceptable hatred. And nobody will bat an eyelid. I've had people, you know, grab my body in the street in London. I've had people shout stuff at me. I've had people throw stuff at me. And people think that's okay. People will just stand by and they'll let that happen. The only people that come to my aid around that are other fat people. And it's shocking. And I think it's completely unacceptable. And that's what fat activism is at the heart of it. It's just saying, treat fat people like human beings.
Makes sense.
You'd say that, but, you know, you look at any article about fat people and the comments will be 90% ill-educated vitriol. It will just be pure hatred. There won't be any actual science behind it. And they have no idea why you're fat. They have no idea what has caused it, or whether it's just that you eat lots of food, whether it's that you're disabled, like I am. You know, there could be a myriad of reasons. It's not really your business what the reasons are. You don't have any claim on that person's life, unless you're that person's family, unless you're that person's doctor. Even then, that is that person's own choice. And it kind of leads to the third point, which is, in the majority of cases, you'll find that it's just that people don't like looking at you. They've got their own aesthetic preferences, and that's all that really matters to them. We call it health trolling, where they bring up all these facts about obesity, and you can say, well, what about a thin, inactive person? What about a thin person that eats red meat every day or drinks 4 or 5 units of alcohol a day? They'll just try and change the subject back onto, oh, but you're fat. And it's like, well, yeah, I am, and I know the health risk, but I personally don't drink and I don't eat red meat and I exercise.
I think it's interesting comparing it to things like smoking and how you wouldn't have a smoking activist, but you have someone like a fat activist. And if we acknowledge that maybe being fat isn't healthy, why is that okay?
It's kind of only one example. It's like, it's the very worst devil's advocate example. The fact is that some of us are at our most healthiest when we're fat. Those of us who are recovering from eating disorders might actually be at our healthiest when we're carrying more weight.
And when we talk about health, we're also talking about mental health as well.
Of course, right. Of course. And I'm definitely at my healthiest now. I've suffered from extremely low self-esteem most of my life, mostly linked to my weight, and a really aggressive inner voice about how much I weigh. When I've weighed a lot less than I do now, there is no one fat person, like there is no one thin person. I've got a friend that runs marathons who is British size 22. But, you know, then there'll be fat people that can't walk for more than a mile. You know, there's no good or bad fat people, like there's no good or bad thin people. But for my personal story, I've always been overweight, but I became the size I am now, which is a British size 20, after becoming disabled and having drastically reduced my mobility. I can walk now, but I couldn't always walk unaided. And I found it very hard to keep the weight off, because I still had to eat. And I've never been one of those people that can eat what they want. I've always been someone that has to be very careful with what I eat. And so for me, that's why I'm fat. And I could have really hated myself for a long time if I hadn't worked on going, well, actually, I have to choose my battles. And by starting from there, I actually then went on this massive path of self-love. And now I think I'm the happiest I've ever been.
That's amazing.
Because the moment, the great secret is, of course, consumerism is built on us hating ourselves, isn't it? All of us, whether we're
so true,
whether we're thin or not, it's built on us hating ourselves so we can buy the thing to make us better. And I see thin friends of mine all the time talking about their weight. You will never be satisfied unless you can accept where you are right now. The basic line is, you cannot wait for your life to start when you hit a certain weight, because you will probably not actually look like you want to when you get there anyway. As I said, my ideal self in my head had longer legs, bigger feet, and had a wider rib cage and smaller breasts. And it's like all these things that I was not going to get to.
Yeah, I think that's one of my biggest gripes is that I hear all these, mostly women, talking about all these ideal bodies, and it's like, that's just not your body shape. And I just really want to emphasise the whole point of body shape and body size, and that it's all different, that some people just are naturally like that, and that's okay.
Absolutely. I get very down as well at the idea that in order to celebrate one body, you have to throw the other body under the bus. Well, that whole controversy around Daisy Ridley recently, who is the actress in Star Wars, when people are saying she's too skinny, and it's like, have you seen her lift? She is in prime health. We don't need to attack her to feel better about who we are.
That's called thin shaming.
Wow. Yeah, it is a slightly different thing, though, I would say. I mean, there's the fact that you're never going to be not hired for being too thin unless it's, like, specifically, I don't know, modelling. But in the majority of industries, you're not going to get turned away from a job for being thin, whereas you will with being fat. It's a reality. You do. This is the other serious side of it. People always talk, oh, it's about what you can buy on the high street, and that is important, but it's not. I mean, you can get rejected for insurance purely based on two numbers on a piece of paper. They won't weigh you. They won't test your fitness. They will just look at it and go, nope. You can get rejected for very important life things which would not be barred to thin people.
Have you ever been rejected for something, or has that ever been a direct experience for you?
Yeah, absolutely. I've been rejected for very important housing insurance based on my BMI. Nothing else. But it's a reality for many people. I've got friends that have been rejected for jobs, very qualified women. You have to dress smarter as well. I mean, if a thin girl goes out in jogging bottoms and sheepskin boots and their hair up in a messy bun, she's bohemian, she's fun. If a fat person does it, they don't love themselves.
You talked about other successful women being turned away from jobs. Mm-hmm. Do you think this affects other genders as well?
I think it does, but I think it's worse for women. I think femme-presenting people, for sure, get it worse.
Can you quickly explain what femme-presenting means?
So if they wear clothing which is traditionally seen as feminine, but people might not necessarily actually be identified as women. But in previous jobs, I've certainly worn very similar outfits to thin colleagues and been told I'm not smart enough, which is upsetting.
Could we be fat activists? Or how could we be an ally?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. And I think listen, everyone says that first, is listen to fat people when they say, I'm good with being called fat. It's an identifier just as anything else. Like, if they're okay with it, don't say, oh, but you're not fat, you're beautiful. That's my biggest bugbear. I hate when people say that to me. I am both. That's fine. Listen to what they want to be called. Listen to their gripes. Listen to the concern and take it seriously. It's always frustrating when people hijack conversations. You know, when somebody says, this is a really hard thing for a fat woman, and it's like, oh yeah, all women slightly feel that, you know. It's like, but it is different for fat women. There is a greater level of violence, and I would call it violence, against them. But yeah, if you can listen to that and not bring in your own body criticism as well, I think that's another big point. I don't mind reading or listening to my friends have their weight concerns, but what you've got to remember is, for somebody who's thinking, well, I want to lose 4 or 5 pounds to fit in that dress, you're talking about being in the game, and we're talking about being so far outside that race. You know, we're not in that game anymore. I'll just describe my body type a little bit, actually, on that note. I'm largely hourglass. I've got a bit of a stomach. I'm short, but I'm also just a size 20. I mean, to some people that will sound horrific, but I am just a size 20. I am a moderate fat. I am at a size where I can fit in chairs. I'm fitting in a chair right now. I can go on planes. I just about come under the weight restriction on most things. I can have privilege there, which a lot of fat women do not have. I can shop on the high street in some stores where a lot of people can't do that. I think it's very important for me to acknowledge that I have that privilege as well.
I just wanted to quickly touch on how fat people can be disadvantaged in the sense that you can be fat as a result of a disability. Is that fair to say? But then also, to an extent, you're also being disadvantaged because buying things like clothes is more expensive.
It is.
Would it be fair to say that class almost comes into this?
Class is a massive part of fat politic, to be honest, because it's not so bad in the UK. I say not so bad. It is still a problem. But in America, to buy the sort of food that will give you a healthy start, a healthy lifestyle, or would be seen as good eating, is extraordinarily expensive compared to buying fast food and buying things that are cheap and filling and do have nutritional value. Over here it's a little bit easier, but there's still a massive problem with accessible food. And that feeds into it. There is a class divide. I don't want to get too much into fat narrative, because it's very easy to say that there are good fats and there are bad fats. There are people that are trying their best and they're striving, and then there are people that are just lazy and feeding into that stereotype. I don't like those stereotypes. Everyone's got their own story. But for my own personal story, I did have an upbringing where I wasn't eating regularly and I didn't have the nutritional understanding that a lot of young people might have, or a lot of families might have. And I didn't have an active childhood because I had a disabled mother as well. And that does feed into it. If you do not have access to that, and if that is not something that you grow up with, I think there's studies now that show that if you are a fat child, you will probably always be fat. And I think it can be very classist to say, oh, well, everyone has access to certain diets and certain gyms and certain lifestyles. Like, I'm sorry, but I know it's not true, but there are certain people that think that the vegan lifestyle is, although it's very good for you, it is prohibitively expensive. And people like Jack Monroe have proved that that's not the case, but that's through a lot of work on their part. You know, they have really researched into this.
That's the thing, we can't all be nutritionists mm-hmm. or people who like devote our lives to being chefs and running a blog on food. That's just
it's not the reality for every person.
The luxury of time.
And this is the other point that I think is very important. I could dedicate more time to exercise. I do exercise every day, but I could do more. But I have to work because of this government. They will not pay out for my level of disabled. I work part-time, actually, now, because I've been forced into part-time working because of my disability. And so I don't have the financial benefit of being able to afford a personal trainer who could possibly help me, or any of these things that could possibly help me. But then I don't want the help. I'm actually fine with who I am. I know people that, as I said, run marathons and weigh 15, 16 stone. It's not like they are mutually exclusive. You can live the best life you can being fat.
I'm wondering about your intersecting identities in terms of disabled and fat and maybe even your sexual orientation. How do you decide what you are active on?
I mean, I would say that becoming disabled made me a fat activist. And I know a lot of people who have become fat after becoming disabled because you do have to pick your battles. Like if you're in chronic pain, which is my problem, you can't expect to have a consistent lifestyle. And not having a consistent lifestyle will affect your weight. You've got to pick your battle on that. And I could not go down the route of addressing my weight the way society wanted me to and work and have a life and be happy in myself. So I made a very conscious decision that I would come to terms with my body, and that meant coming to terms with the fact I was fat and disabled. So those two really tightly tie in together. I'd say being bisexual, I think with any of these things, living slightly outside what society views as the default always makes you question things more. I do think that the straight world does put a lot of pressure on women to be one type of person. And the silly thing is, of course, a large portion of men don't necessarily want that one ideal. They have a much varied interest as anyone else. And I think that was a big turning point for me when I realised, oh, people still want to have sex with me when I'm fat.
I think that's really important, and I think it plays into the idea of a male gaze in magazines and things, but also if you're bi, it's about who would be interested in you. It's more about the people.
Well, for me it just meant that I can focus on the people, I can focus on being around people that make me feel good, rather than...
Which is a good thing.
Yeah. But you'd be surprised how many people don't focus on that. I mean, especially if you are a fat person and you're constantly being told that your body is disgusting, it makes you feel that your body is disgusting. And if you buy into, oh, well, you can't go on a date and... Oh, there's an advert for a slimming drink at the moment where they say, oh, I'm going to take this for a week because I have a date at the end of the week. I mean, that's a scene, isn't it?
Yeah, that you should alter yourself for a date.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's just, but
most of them are shit anyway.
And it's that thing of going, that idea, though, is really strongly ingrained in our culture. And whenever I was starting to date when I was younger and I was sort of on that borderline, I was a size 16, I was noticeably bigger than other people, but I would still think, God, I don't want to meet this person. What if they don't like me because I'm fat? Now it's like, well, if they don't, they can leave. Who cares? That person is not someone I want to be around.
Yeah, and that's brilliant.
So what do you say to people who say that you're championing an unhealthy lifestyle?
See, that's a really interesting question. I mean, I just think I'm just championing living the best life I can. And I'm championing other people to live the best life they can. I don't think that people should be not exercising, but they shouldn't think that exercise and eating a better diet is going to fix all their problems, because it might not. What I am championing is people not treating people that are fat as if they are lesser. That's what I'm championing. I want people to stop thinking that they can motivate people with hate, because they cannot. I spent so much of my young life motivating myself with hatred, or trying to. I would try and go for runs, and all in time my head, whenever I started to feel tired, it was just like, you're a fat bitch, you can't do this, you can't do this, you're never going to be an acceptable person, you might as well fucking give up now. That was the constant stream in my head. I'd look in the mirror and I'd be like, you're fucking disgusting, nobody will love you. That was my constant narrative through every day of my life. I didn't need to hear it from anyone else, but they would still fucking say it. Because they think it's their right to say it to me. I'm championing people being able to look in the mirror and say, I'm okay with what I see. I'm okay with who I am.
So what would you say to your younger self? What would you say to 14-year-old Ray?
I would say the cliche, it gets better. But it does get better. It does. The moment you can kind of look at your body and go, this is what I have, is the moment you'll be able to just enjoy your life. 14-year-old me is just actually starting down the road of an eating disorder. So that's a really interesting age you've chosen there. And I would say, save yourself the trouble, because you will get to 16 and you will still be a size 14 to 16. You will still look to everyone else like you're chubby, even though you can see all your ribs, even though you can see your hip bone. You will still look fat. Society will tell you, you look fat. So stop worrying and just live your life.
Own it.
And it's not just something I would say to fat kids either. It's just something I would say to every young woman. Yeah, you might have a pear shape, so what? You might have one breast bigger than the other, so what? Society is set up so you do not love yourself.
Yeah.
They really want you to not love yourself. If you're fat, if you're too skinny in their eyes, if your breasts are too small, if you have thighs that touch, the whole thigh gap thing, my God. And people are obsessed with this. And whatever you look like, the first thing is loving yourself. And once you start there, you can start to be the person you want to be. That sounds so trite.
It sounds so kick-ass. That's what
yeah,
it sounds lovely. Like.
You're a kick-ass.
I mean, if you think about, you know, we walk into any corner shop and the kind of magazines you'll see and mm-hmm. the headlines and stuff, that is not trite. That is kick-ass. That is exactly what we should be telling every single one
yeah,
of us. That's... And we should be writing on our mirrors, so it's the first thing you see when you wake up in the morning.
Oh, yeah. I mean, a big part is also stop reading those magazines.
Yeah.
Just get them out of your life. Stop listening to those people. Realise that they're selling you something. Get out of the system. You know, just start focusing
Don't
on yourself.
Play the game.
Don't play the game. That's it. No matter what size you are, do not play that game because you will end up losing. And also, you know, self-love isn't easy. You've got to work at it. And I think that's a really important thing as well. So many women are told that, all women, I would say, are told that loving themselves is an indulgence and it's not, it's essential. Taking that time to enjoy your body, to spend time with yourself, to masturbate, to really
Preach.
Actually, yeah, exactly. But to actually, you know, but how many young women don't do that because they are scared of their bodies?
It's, right, because they're
a big
told,
deal.
Yeah, they're told they're made to feel guilty,
yeah,
for being a woman,
yeah, and for being indulgent in yourself. And I think that's a really important thing. Enjoy being in your body. Enjoy what your body does. Relish every little detail about it, and you will start to love yourself. Focus in, don't focus out.
Yes.
That's brilliant.
Yeah.
Oh, right. You have been a kick-ass guest. Okay. Listeners, you couldn't see us, but Elena and I were definitely nodding for most of that.
The whole way.
Do you want to share? Because we found you through the London Fat Activist Clothes Swap.
Of course, yeah.
Do you
want
to shout out about that?
So it's not my project, but it's a fantastic project. There is a group on Facebook called Fat Positive London, which is an excellent group, which is free of weight loss talk. It's free of diet talk. It's all about being fat and being you at that moment and finding a supportive community of like-minded people who are happy just the way they are. And a subgroup of that is the Fat Positive Clothes Swap, which is a fantastic place to pick up a range of clothes from usually from about size 18 all the way up to about size 32. And it's you get some real fantastic bargains there from professional models and bloggers and just other really fashionable fat folk. And I highly recommend, if you are a fat person in the UK, signing up for those groups and coming to join us and making some friends.
Yay!
I really like the fashionable fat folk. I like the alliteration there.
That was cool.
Brilliant.
Ashna, introduce yourself.
I am Ashna, as you say. I'm a 23-year-old cisgendered, straight, female British Mauritian. So I was born in England, but both my parents are originally from Mauritius. I'm a journalist working in television and I'm based in Bristol. And I would say that I'm a bit of an optimist and I like to smile a lot.
When did you first become aware of beauty standards?
I definitely first became aware of it from a very young age. I think it's from watching television, especially watching, my mum used to watch these Asian soap dramas on television, and it would completely just be fair-skinned women, very, very pretty, very sort of Western view of how pretty they were. But it was definitely through magazines, and I recognised the differences between me and the models in the magazines, and I think that's what made me more aware of what beauty standards were growing up in England.
Can you be a feminist and wear makeup?
I would definitely say you can. Absolutely. Because I think makeup is fun. It's an art, I think. And personally, I find it quite empowering putting makeup on. You know, I don't do my eyeliner nicely and flicked in a funky way for anyone else but myself. I quite enjoy the fact that my eyebrows look on fleek, you know?
So. Do you ever have any difficulty when it comes to finding makeup to suit your shade of skin?
It's a constant bugbear trying to find makeup to suit my skin shade, and I think a lot of Asian women would agree, and people from the black community as well. But also, not only just finding products that match our skin tone, but also finding affordable products. A lot of products that do these shades sort of brands like MAC or Lancôme or Dior, and you know, they're quite pricey, and it's just not so easy to get your drugstore brands, you know, like your Maybelline and stuff. And this lady at work commented on how she'd been to Birmingham for the weekend. This is a white lady, and she couldn't find any, you know, white makeup, so to speak, any makeup to suit her skin tone up there, because it was all darker shades. And I found that particularly interesting. Wonder whether, you know, it's geographically based, which sounds bizarre.
Did you tell her welcome to my world or something?
Yeah, I did. I was a bit like, well, that's how I feel all the time. Yeah. And they didn't get me started on skin colored tights.
Oh, interesting. Can you tell us a bit about that? Because that's something like, yeah, I've never had to think about.
Do you know, I went to an all-girls school, a secondary school, and it was seen as the norm that you would have to wear skin-coloured tights in summer. And I just didn't have, they didn't sell skin-coloured tights. And people found this bizarre, but it obviously is not really something people think about unless it's a genuine issue for you. So I was walking around, I was trying to look in all these tight sections, and nowhere sold tights that were appropriate for my skin tone, and I just end up having to wear black tight in summer.
I remember being 10 and reading Mallory Blackman's Noughts and Crosses, and there was a section about the plasters, and that totally blew my mind, because I'd never ever thought about the fact that skin coloured plasters were always pink. They were always like my kind of pink. But I remember like the penny drop moment. Is that the same? Is that a bit like tights?
Oh yeah, definitely. It's, you know, it's so much more obvious when you've got a plaster on your leg, when your skin tone is different to that of a plaster. And that's why I'd usually buy the see-through one. But having sort of a light cream plaster on you, it does stand out. It really does. But also, speaking of plasters, the other thing that I find quite strange is that still, even with all this talk about diversity and, you know, just different skin tones, in a box of crayons, the pale neutral colour of the pinky colour is still called skin.
I had no idea. What do you do for tights now?
Oh, this is still a constant issue. I just don't wear skin colour tights because there aren't any.
Does this piss you off? I mean, I know you're optimistic and smiley, but...
Oh, no. Optimistic and smiley, but also, it's just not fair, really. And there was a candidate on The Apprentice last year who I think she was planned... She brought this up as an issue. And her business idea was to create tights for all shades of skin. And whilst that's a great idea, at least make them affordable. I think there are tights out there. They're priced at like £30 for five pairs of tights. I can't afford that.
Also, you get holes in tights so easily.
Yeah, that's not economical.
So, Ashna, I understand that you've done a documentary on shadism.
Yes, that's right.
Tell us about that. Tell us like what you learn and how we can listen to it and just all about it.
So I did a documentary, a radio documentary on shadism, and I basically found out that we as women, as self-conscious as it is, there are methods for harming ourselves for beauty all around us. You know, people pluck their eyebrows, shaving, and even plastic surgery. So it was seemed bizarre to me why people were putting skin lightening products or lotions onto their skin and risk burning their skin or scarring themselves to destroy the melanin cells that are in their body because they didn't like the colour of themselves. These skin lighteners contain everything from mercury to a chemical called hydroquinone, and it was so damaging. And it was a practice from when they were 7 years old. It was ingrained in them that that was the normal thing to do. But I definitely learned that, especially the companies that produce these products, they thrive on that insecurity within young women, young men as well. Companies exploit that fear that it's revolting to be too dark, and they use the success stories to brand their products, which is so harmful. Oh, and you can listen to it on my blog from ashnaspastiche.com.
So I want to talk about the new Nina Simone movie. And there's been quite a lot of controversy over the fact that Zoe Saldana is playing Nina Simone. And she's had a lot of hate, basically, for the fact that she is a lot lighter than Nina Simone originally was. And has been kind of trashed for blackfacing, almost, in the fact that they've had to make Zoe Saldana darker to play the role of Nina Simone. And I was just wondering, can you comment on the fact Zoe Saldana is receiving all this hate for it? And also, is it blackfacing if you're already black?
So I think Zoe Saldana's casting in the movie it highlights that never-ending battle for women of colour to be cast in leading roles. So here you've got a black woman being told that their African or Caribbean qualities are still not good enough, or in this case with Zoe, that she's not light enough to then pretend to be dark enough. So here, Nina is a music icon that everyone knows the face of, and her image is being skewed in order to make an attractive, quote, Hollywood movie. But I think it's once again showing that the colour and shade of a black woman's skin is being displayed as a hindrance and a setback. On the flip side, I think Saldana, I think she spoke to In Style magazine and she said that Elizabeth Taylor wasn't right for the Cleopatra role either. So perhaps an artist is colourless, is genderless. So is it part of the art form itself?
That's a really interesting point. But then having said that, Elizabeth Taylor, that movie would have been cast, I don't know when, years ago? And you would have thought that maybe we would have got a bit more progressive. But then again, having said that, if it's an art form, does it matter?
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely a debate to be had. But I do think, surely, out of all the black actors in the whole of the world, could they really not find anybody that would be able to perpetuate that role?
That's what it comes back to, isn't it? How many roles are there for black actors?
I mean, I don't want to trash talk Zoe Saldana because she's an artist, but the fact that they've had to, like, I don't know, in quotation marks, black her up, when there are so many talented actresses like Viola Davis who are absolutely killing it in film and TV, and it's like, did you need to do that?
Yeah.
Could you tell us some more about shadism? Because you said you might have some insight from the Asian community.
Absolutely. So shadism, or some people call it colourism, it's discrimination based on your skin colour. So it's a form of prejudice in which people are treated differently based on the social meanings attached to their skin colour. The basics of it are, the more tanned your skin is, the lower your class, and the fairer your skin, the wealthier and the more attractive you are. Discrimination that causes self-loathing and prompts the use of skin whiteners or lightening products.
So then how does this affect the Asian community?
A huge issue still in the Asian community, particularly when it comes down to marriage or career prospects. There are so many skin lightening brands out there that seem to keep multiplying, like Fair and Lovely. And I think the name just says it all, really. The fairer your skin, the lovelier you are, the cleverer you are, the better you are. It's a concept that has been ingrained in so many people, not just in Asian communities. You know, India, it's a huge, huge issue over there. They actually have among the highest amount of products they make in India for this purpose. From the documentary, I realised that it's actually not an issue that's dying out and they're prepared to suffer for it.
So, Ashna, have you ever been on, like, the receiving end of some shadism? Like, do you have any experiences that you're, like, willing to share?
Yeah, absolutely. Growing up, a lot of people would say to my mum, you know, your daughter's quite dark, maybe you should keep her out of the sun. It was a constant underlying thought in many relatives that I'm darker than also most women in my family. You know, it was always seen as normal that Ashna can't sit on that sun lounger, she has to sit on the one with the umbrella on it, because she can't be in the sun. And, oh, getting skin lightening creams for Christmas, like, what the hell?
What? Oh, wow.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, not by any, this is not nothing to do with my parents at all. It would just be relatives, you know, just like, oh, just try this cream. It's really good for clearing up your skin / whitening your skin.
The story about the sun loungers and never being allowed in the sun, that's pretty shocking. The Christmas presents, because I remember being given things like fake nail sets for Christmas, and I'd be like, I don't know what the hell you think I want to do with this. But like, to think that maybe the equivalent, but more entrenched in racism, I suppose, and in structure. So now you're quite successful at what you do, being in TV journalism. How do your family see that, your wider family?
They're all, you know, incredibly pleased. But it's interesting, though, that television has moved so quickly and it's become such an acceptance to be of any shade. Anyone can be on TV. But I don't think that I would be accepted in the same way as a journalist as I am here if I were to work in somewhere like India. I genuinely feel that I would be too dark for them to put on screen. It is so evident still in their sitcoms, in their television programme, that women have to be a certain shade to be on screen.
So you feel like it would be easier to be a TV journalist in England?
Yeah, definitely.
Wow.
Or in somewhere like America. Western, I definitely think they're more accepting.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Which is weird. You would think it would be the opposite because, I guess, stereotypically, that England is lighter skinned than somewhere like India.
I think it's because most you watch TV and the people on TV are seen as people to aspire to, and that's why people of lighter shades of skin tone are on so many different shows in India, because you see the programmes and you think, oh, I'd love to look like her, I'd love to look like him, you know, just because of the way they look.
So do you think India is aspiring to Western ideals of beauty in very generic terms, but that maybe, for example, the UK and America, they're trying to appear a bit more diverse because a lot, I don't know, there must be quite a lot of migration of different ethnicities, and so they're trying to, I don't know, is the UK any more diverse?
I think people are too scared to call out countries like India, because I mean, I don't know how Barbara feels about this, but certainly in India there's just so much to want to be lighter because of the people that appear on screen, and I think people are too scared to say something about it.
I have a friend who's Tamil, and he said that it was absolutely revolutionary for him when he saw on Netflix the Masters of None, and he saw the actor whose name I've totally forgotten right now.
Aziz Ansari, yes.
That is it. And because he said it was the first time that he saw someone who looked like him as the main character in a TV show.
Absolutely. I rang up my brother as soon as I saw that show.
I think that's such an interesting experience that white people just are completely unaware of, that the complete excitement to see someone who looks like you on TV.
I've never called my brother to tell him that there's someone who looks like him on TV, because I'd be ringing him all the time and I don't want to talk to him that much. I was talking to one of my friends and we were trying to figure out when I first became aware of beauty standards, and I think I actually realised around 6 that I looked like what people were supposed to, in that if I opened any magazine or if I saw any children's book, I saw kids who were blonde hair and blue eyes, and I realised that quite young. And she was saying that she never had that. She's half Polish and half Jamaican, and when it came to World Book Day, she had absolutely no idea what to dress as because there were no characters that looked like her, and her friends told her that she couldn't be a princess. This is just stuff that you hear and it goes straight to your heart, and you just think, what the heck of this world have I been living in that thinks that that's okay to tell young people, to tell anybody? And how ridiculous is it that I haven't ever thought about it until I'd reached 24?
There's been this I've seen in articles recently that some people have commented saying, is contouring shadism in disguise? So where contouring is concerned, the objective is usually to create the illusion of chiseled bone structure using a blend of light or dark shade with makeup. But for people whose beauty lies in the broadness or the bluntness of their features, streamlining noses and cheekbones to European standards does seem like a little bit suspect. I don't think contouring is shadism in disguise. I think it just so happens to be that somehow you're creating illusions with light and dark shades just to create that look that you're after.
So you have gone into journalism, and specifically TV journalism, is that fair to say?
Yeah.
Did you ever have any concerns about getting into TV journalism because of the shade of your skin?
Well, I know that there aren't many television journalists who are from a diverse background. So I went into the industry very aware of this. I actually got into my job at the moment through a diversity scheme because it encouraged positive discrimination in a newsroom, in any newsroom. But I think it's a bonus. I think if I can have a successful career and I'm a person of colour and I'm encouraging other people of colour to get into an industry they would otherwise not consider, then I'm definitely proud of that.
I think that's interesting that you got in on like a diversity scheme. So in some ways, that I think people would agree that that's a good thing and that we're actively encouraging diversity. But then at the same time, could it be counterintuitive in that we're not basing it on merit?
Yeah, absolutely. I think a lot of people might think it's that, but that's the other issue with the diversity scheme. They might think, why didn't you apply for other schemes as well? But I did apply for other schemes as well. It just so happened that I got through it via this way. I don't know if I wholly agree with the whole quota thing. I think that it has to be a balance between both, between reflecting the audience that you're serving. So as a television organisation, are you reflecting that in your broadcasting? But also, do they have the merit to complete those jobs?
I think I've definitely got my own opinions about this, because I definitely think that organisations should be actively trying to get more diverse people as part of their organisation. Mm. And I mean that in terms, and I'm very passionate about it, in terms of everything, in terms of sexual orientation, the 9 protected characteristics of the Equality Act, which include things like age and disability and marriage status. And mm-hmm. because organisations actually fundamentally perform better when A, people can be themselves, but also B, when they are more diverse, because you get more of a range of different points of view, and together it means that you think about strategies different ways. And when you become somewhere that celebrates the things that make people different, it really can transform the workplace. And I think that as it stands, the world isn't fair. It is much easier for a white man who's non-disabled, who's straight, to literally just have the confidence to go up to that person in that bar, start networking and get the opportunity to get to the job interview, so he already knows the person who's on the panel, to get the job. And I think that's much harder for everybody else. And this isn't even talking about class, for goodness sake. Mm-hmm. And I think organisations that recognise this and actively try and take steps to... I think quotas is a really interesting debate, and we should probably devote an entire episode to it, to be honest. But recognising and celebrating diversity is something that we should not be afraid to do more. I think we are organisations who are made up of mostly decision panels that are mostly white, able, non-disabled men. They are afraid of saying, oh, we're a little bit racist because of the way that we do our applications. Actually, you can see the name of the candidate and you can see that it's a different sounding name. So mm-hmm. we need to be open and honest and appreciate where we come from and then celebrate it and do things like through HR procedures, but also recognise that it's not enough. I'm going off on a rant here, but if an organisation is LGBT inclusive but doesn't explicitly say anything anywhere, nobody will think that it is. If you just say, we like equality, nobody knows what that means. If you say, we appreciate and value individuals and especially encourage them to apply, especially if they are LGBT, if they come from a working class background, that's the kind of organisation that you will go, I want to be a part of that.
Yeah, and I think what's really promising is that people like Glenny Henry, he spoke about it at the BAFTAs. He said he's trying to get a diversity clause put into the BBC's Royal Charter. And I think if the BBC do that, it's going to encourage other organisations to follow suit.
It would be fucking amazing. And it would probably be about high time, wouldn't it?
Oh, yeah. Head nod. Time.
Yeah. We need more diversity on our screens and on our radio stations. And, yeah. Power to the people!
Amen to that. Ashna, this has been really, really interesting. Thank you so much for coming on. Is there anything else, maybe anything that you're working on that you want to plug, or you want to plug your Twitter or anything that we can support you with?
Yeah, definitely would love everybody to follow me on Twitter if you have it, at AshnaJH, and feel free to tweet me any sassy memes, because I love a good sassy meme.
Wicked.
Excellent.
Now joined by Barbara. So do you want to introduce yourself?
Hi, my name's Barbara Ntumi. I am 20-something. I'm a student currently finishing my undergrad, and I am a business owner. I'm very active in a lot of politics, especially pertaining to anti-racism, anti-fascism.
What elements of beauty are you interested in talking about?
I'm interested in talking about makeup. I belong to a beauty of colour makeup group, and there will be a small section in society that know exactly what I'm talking about, and I actually really love it right now. So me saying beauty of colour Facebook group, it's like a code. As a black woman myself, you know, hair can be seen as political. How no other group of people have their hair discussed, scrutinized, analyzed, gone over, thought about, written about, sung about in the way the black women have. So that's something that I like to plug my ears into and listen to and contribute to. I think a lot of beauty is shaped by your personal experience. For me personally, I remember when I was younger, my mum used to always say that I was beautiful. And growing up, people used to comment on looks and looking beautiful, etc. and stuff. I've realized, like, in the last couple of years, I've struggled with my response to that. If somebody says to me, oh, you look really beautiful, I've struggled with it. Like, I'd just be really awkward for some strange reason. And I noticed that about, like, 2 years ago. And I've been actively myself doing work to be like, well, if someone says you're beautiful, just, you know, embrace it. It's a nice compliment to give someone, although you should give compliments more than their beauty and what they look like. But beauty is subjective again. It might not necessarily them commenting on what you look like. They might be commenting on the way you are, the way you speak. It can mean all sorts of things.
I've worked really hard. If anyone ever gives me a compliment, I will say thank you. Even if I catch other people saying, oh, yeah, no, oh, then I'm like, no. You listen to that compliment, you put it in your pocket, and you save it for a rainy day when you're feeling like crap.
That is so true.
It's funny how that's like our default response to be like, oh, really? Oh, no, I don't think so. And it's like, no, embrace
Own it.
It, beauty.
Yeah, and the disparaging thing we do, like, oh, God, I look like shit, or whatever. Like, you start making excuses. It's like, no. This person has said to them right now, this moment, they believe that you're beautiful. Just take it.
Yeah, exactly.
And, you know, it's the internal work that we all have to do, right? You know, because of how we've been socialized and brought up. It's just one of those things that you have to, like, kind of put on your list and say, oh, these are some of the things that I need to work on. I am also in another hair group. It's called Black Hair Forum. Again, a section of people know exactly what I'm talking about, and I'm just happy about it. But I'll talk of Beauty of Colour first. So Beauty of Colour is a lot of the discussions and a lot of stuff we do that is about makeup, but we talk about much wider stuff. We talk about, like, colorism. We talk about what's classed as beautiful, what's classed as good looks, and what isn't. Again, like, we call people out and stuff. It's a very, like, friendly learning community, and people give people tips, and people tell people, oh, this is where you can get this. And if you, like, you know, if you have an issue, i.e. like, your foundation doesn't match anymore, as, you know, the seasons are changing, especially for black women in particular, when the sun comes out, and, you know, we've been hibernating in the winter, most people's skin tone change, which means, like, they wake up 2 days later and the makeup that they put on does not match anymore, which is probably where capitalism gets your money, but that's another conversation. But it's very nice. We support each other, and it's, I think, most of all, it's about celebrating. Every time somebody posts and I go in there and, you know, I see just how beautiful they are. They're different shades, different color, different types.
You mentioned colorism. What is that?
The way I understand colorism is that it particularly is an issue that is within the black community. And when I say black, I'm using, like, a very broad political term, but I'm going to be more specific. So for me as an African, there are different tones and shades and hues, and don't get too technical, of blackness. Like, some people are a lot darker, some people are a lot lighter. And colorism goes back to colonial politics, really. It really goes that deep and that far, as in people who were lighter were described and were asserted as being closer to whiteness and therefore more favorable, right? And those of us that were darker were not as favorable, and that really feeds into a lot of racism and racist ideologies, which then these people internalize, because pre anybody coming to tell you that, oh, this is much more nicer and this color is much more prettier, in terms of just the media and everything of that nature, in film and television, all of that stuff, you can see that there's definitely a difference. And people who are public facing tend to have a certain look in terms of just the skin color. It has a deeper impact on relations with people, and how other people who are necessarily ascribed to that look are made to feel like they're not as pretty or not as beautiful, they can be as successful. And it's really sad because then it kind of borders into a very medical thing in the sense where you have darker skinned people, people who perceive themselves to be darker. That's the other problem as well. There are people who you can say, oh, this person's visibly dark. But then there's the issue of people perceiving themselves to be darker and trying to get as closer to white as they can because they feel like that's the best position to be in, lightening their skin, and which can cause very, very harmful medical problems for them. It's just very insidious how like this very racist ideology is internalized by a group of people and then in the long run has health effects.
How is that reflected in makeup?
That is reflected in makeup, as in I can never buy a foundation from certain brands because when I go into a shop, so this is a real story, I was in Sheffield, I'd run out of foundation and I normally buy a particular brand because I know that they cater specifically to my skin tone and to black people, and most beauty brands don't. It's probably the reason why I did not start wearing makeup until like maybe 2-3 years ago, because you have to go to a type of superdrug or a type of boots. And these are the things that we share in Beauty of Colour. We go, oh, this superdrug has foundation in our skin tone. This is where you should go if you want to buy it. So I went into the superdrug and I was looking and I did not find the brand that I wanted. I was like, okay, well, maybe I have to try something new. So I looked at all the other brands and it's like I didn't exist. So I spoke to a lady in the shop and I said to her, is this the darker that you get? And I say darker, and that's not in reference to actually the makeup being dark. It was still very white as far as I'm concerned. And she's like, oh, yeah, that's all we have. I was like, but this is Sheffield. I'm like, people that look like me live here. That's part of the problem, that a lot of things have to be special ordered or you have to go to a specific shop and it's not as available or as accessible as other things are to other groups of people, or predominantly white people, for example. I do think that things are definitely getting better. I do think that attention is being paid to those things, although be it in a very capitalist way. Like, there's the argument people are like, oh, there's a whole other market that you're not selling to. It's like, okay, maybe that works for you, but the general principle is maybe you should just provide makeup for everybody, no matter what they look like. And I mean, I understand the argument, but obviously as an anti-capitalist person, it always grates me the wrong way.
Your motivation should be diversity and celebrating it, not necessarily making more money.
Exactly.
For yourselves.
Yeah.
I think that was interesting that you said that you kind of have to specially order things and that can get expensive. And then that's just like an extra cost. And that's something that people, white people, don't have to expense.
Yeah, that is true. So this is another makeup story. And like my whole life doesn't revolve this way. But there's a Boots near uni, Islington area, being very London centric right now. And the makeup brand that I normally buy, which is the one that matches my skin tone, that I've always bought since I started wearing makeup, I went to the shop and it had it there, which for me is like a win. Like, you're onto a winner already. Then I looked at what they had on offer and I found something that matched me, but not specifically like the particular item I was looking for. And I kept going like every other 3 weeks or so to see if this particular thing I was looking for would come and they'd stock up. And after like, it's been like 4 months now and it still hasn't come. So I spoke to the lady and I was like, oh, so you're not going to sell this brand product because that's the thing that they make. She was like, oh, you know, I don't know. This is all that we have. And it's like, yeah, but you've restocked everything else in the shop except this brand. It does not make any sense to me. She's like, oh, obviously she's not probably the right person to ask on issues like this. She probably has no involvement in that. But that again speaks to a certain level of understanding that people have. It's like, oh, we'll stock everything else but this particular brand, which I'm not going to buy that people don't know that a certain group of people buy from this brand, because that's the way that this brand markets itself. So to not, whether consciously or subconsciously, not refill the items of that brand just speaks to something more to me. Like, you don't care. Like, whatever you're going to offer, we're going to buy it anyway. So what's the point? I don't know why I'm laughing.
So when did you become aware of beauty standards?
The thing that has always made me aware of beauty standards has been Beyoncé.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
I am the unofficial, official East London coordinator of the Beehive.
Sick.
This is my Twitter bio, so it's true. / the J-Hive. Jeremy Corbyn. Anyway.
I thought you meant Jay-Z.
No, me too.
Anyway. Okay, tell us about Beyoncé.
Right, Beyoncé. So because of what Beyoncé looks like and how successful she is and how much I love her music, I think she's made me very aware of beauty and the standard of beauty. Because so Beyoncé did an ad, you can find a makeup ad anyway, it's the only brand that I think she's done a makeup ad for, so if you went on the internet you could work this out. Basically, I think it has been written about, but if you speak to especially black women, particularly about their ad, Beyoncé was white up. right? And it was a way for this brand to say, oh, but we do cater to black people. Look, Beyonce. Like, Beyonce is the person that people wheel at when they say black people. And it's like, okay, but all black people don't look like Beyonce. So you're clearly missing out on something there. And Beyonce is a different kind of black person, as in, like, she's successful, she's American, she has a certain look that not all black women have per se. So for me, I think her music, watching her music videos, and in many cases as well, like Rihanna coming to the scene, because I remember when she came to some of the black women, I was like, oh, okay, so there is a certain look and it's very specific. And I think of all the other black women artists there are that I really like that are not necessarily as huge or as famous, people like Jill Scott and other people who also look a particular way, i.e. are a lot darker in terms of their skin tone, in terms of the way that they look generally, and don't wear long blonde hair or whatever, have a certain level of appreciation. It's not as high as Beyonce and, say, Rihanna and other people are. And that's not necessarily just like appreciation from the black community, but appreciation from people, full stop, because Beyonce doesn't only have black fans. Like, she has other people as well who appreciate her. And just made me really aware of what the difference of that kind of beauty and what people perceive as beauty and what the standard is. Like, what are you aiming to? You know, there's a joke like, oh, you know, I'm trying to aim to Beyonce level or whatever, or Rihanna level. It's never, oh, I'm trying to aim to like Jill Scott level or Lauryn Hill level. And even if that's brought up, right, that in itself, like, let's take Lauryn Hill, for example, that's used as another standard that black women must get up to bash other black women. It's like, oh, but why are you wearing weaves and loads of makeup? Look at Lauryn Hill, she's like really natural and afro and stuff. Like, you just can't win. And for me, it's really sad that people can't see that the lesson we learn is there are different types of beauty. People look different. Like, that's why there's a Rihanna and there's a Beyonce and there's a Lauryn Hill and there's a Jill Scott. Like, that's why there are all these people, because we don't all look the same, and that's okay, that's fine.
Yeah, totally. You touched a little bit on hair just then.
Yeah,
about natural hair and weaves and stuff. Do you want to talk a bit about the politics of black hair?
Yeah. I mean, up until I went natural myself, I didn't think the hair was political. I really didn't. Like I said, I'm African myself and I was born in Ghana. I grew up in Ghana. So I feel like I'm fairly in touch with stuff like that. And I remember how when I was really, really young, I got my hair relaxed, which is like chemically straightened. And I've always done it ever since then. And it's just the way that I've thought that my hair to be done. And when I think about it, the people that I grew up with, my aunties, my mum, everybody, that's just what they did. And obviously the context in Ghana is like a former British colony. Yes, we gained independence, but then there was a counter-revolution and then we have a dictatorship for a while. I think some things were lost in terms of, yes, we fought for independence and there was this whole thing about Pan-Africanism, and it was Marxist at its heart and revolutionary at its heart, which feeds into why hair is a political thing. And if you look at that era, people wore their hair natural. Obviously, what extent was that work done to carry on? Obviously, that was defeated because you have a generation, my mum's generation, my mum's like in her mid-60s, and then subsequently me, who were following this unchallenged narrative of, oh, you have to relax your hair and that's just what you do. And not talking about the impact it has on your health. Again, it's just really crazy how all these beauty and all these things that are enforced in us and saying, oh, we have to be the this, tend to have a very negative impact on our health. But people don't raise it as a thing because obviously the overriding nature of racism is so dominant. It's like, you know, I wanna fit in, I wanna ascribe to this thing that I'm supposed to be, that you put your health in the line, like you put that in danger because you're trying to aspire to this thing that you're probably never going to be. So hair is very important for black women, especially. I'm of the opinion that you can do whatever you want with your hair. What I do want black women to understand is all the facts, like have all the options. I think that's really important. I don't think I've ever had that. Like, I was young and I was told this is what I was supposed to do and blah, blah. And in many ways, like people like me who grow older and then decide not to relax their hair and go natural, for us, it is a political act because it's like, oh, I'm defying all these things I was told younger, that this is what I was supposed to look like, this is what I was supposed to be. But then the other thing is, women must be given the freedom and the space to do what they would like. I don't believe in judging and telling other people, oh, your hair should be not, like, you do what you want. The internet is there. Oh god, wonderful thing, this thing. You can do all the research you want to do, you can find out, and if you still decide that you want to relax your hair, that is your choice. You are allowed to have that. I think for me, the key thing is people understanding that there are other ways and not just one way, and making the choice which path they want to go down. But then there's also the political thing about hair is also for me, when people say, oh, try not to look as European as possible. And this goes back to you picking up on the hair thing. Oh, there's the Rihanna aesthetic of straight blonde, like Rihanna's done all the colours in the world, girl. Then there's the likes of Lauryn Hill and Jill Scott, who famously and infamously, and like if you look through their aesthetic and their pictures and what they look like, have not entirely, but most of the time, ascribed to a Afro, what is classed as natural look, and what message that sends. And you can be both. This is the thing that people don't understand. You can have an Afro today and have a straight blonde weave tomorrow. Like, that is your choice to do. It's really important that you understand the context of which you're operating in. And it's really disheartening when you do hear stories like black women working in high-end stuff told that they can't have braids and they can't have cornrows, when people who are not African, for example, because I'm going to go with African Caribbean because that's where cornrow and braids and stuff like that come from, do it. And it's like, oh my god, it's so edgy, it's so cool, it's like, that's part of my culture, that's how my people have evolved and stayed close to our roots, like this is part of our history and how we've existed, and you're telling me that I can't be like that because you believe that it's not professional. It's about who gets to decide that. Black people don't get to decide that. Somebody else gets to decide that for us, and then you have to fall in line, and you have a situation where people are choosing between whether they can have a job or have their hair the way they want to. It's just crazy, isn't it?
Yeah, especially when you say it like that. It's just like mind-blowing.
It is mind-blowing.
The choice. So why is hair an issue worth worrying about? I often hear a lot of the time like the kind of pick your battles argument, in that like, oh yeah, I'm all for racial equality, but we should be tackling wage gaps and homelessness. Like, we shouldn't be talking about hair. Why is hair an important issue to talk about?
It is an important issue because if we don't fight for my right to exist, to wear my hair however I want to, giving me equal pay is not going to make a difference to me, is it? Like, it is going to make a difference materially, but am I living to the full extent of my life in the way that I'm supposed to be? I'm not. So we don't have to pick between the pay gap and hair. For me, they're just as important. To be able to walk down in the street with my hair the way I wanted to, with my hair the way generations from me in the African continent have had it, and to be paid as equally as a man, it's not really for choice, is it? I didn't get to pick those things. Those things should be given to me because of who I am, right? I should be able to live that life because it's one life. It's not separate. Me being able to have my hair the way I want to isn't being able to have equal pay, among other, you know, feminist issues. It should be part of the whole struggle. The struggle encompasses a lot of things, and white can't hair be part of that? It's really important, especially to black women. The notion that someone's telling me that I should choose is actually, quite frankly, ridiculous. And there are spaces for those conversations to be had. Like, obviously, if you're having a meeting about the wage gap, I ain't gonna come in there and be like, my hair. Do you know what I mean? That's not appropriate. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
I'm not gonna come in there and gonna be like, oh, can I make a contribution? Well, it's just really important that, like, women support black women and their hair. I'm like, I'm not gonna come there and do that because that's not, like, the appropriate place, right?
What can we do as allies then with really straight blonde hair? I should point out that. What could we do as allies?
I think that all black women go through personal hair journeys. The most important thing I'd say is we should be supportive of people's decisions. As white allies, like you were saying, maybe for me, what I can think of right now is listen when women talk about their hair. Because I know, like, it sounds, you know, people say, oh, like, of all the things, you're choosing to talk about hair. And it's like, but maybe that's my route into feminism. Maybe that's my feminism for me, that I'm able to wear my hair however they want. So the issue is about equality, right? And if other women are being beaten with a stick of other women going, oh, your hair should be like this, maybe she's actually not. Your hair should be however you want it to be. And I think for me, that's really at the heart of the issue.
So we should really just keep pushing for there to be diversity in everything.
Yeah.
In makeup and a celebration of it, really.
Yeah. And I don't know if you know, there was a Gap ad in America where they had all these young girls in, and there was a black girl, and everyone was like, yay, black girl. She had dreadlocks. And when people try, and even when you get it wrong, the lesson is to listen to why people are saying that you have got it wrong and maybe try again. Because we never know these things until people try. And basically, at the end of this Gap ad, the scene at the end was just so heartbreaking because you had this white girl basically put her arm. It was sort of, the black girl was like a bit of a stool thing. And you saw the whole thing. You were like, oh, crap. This beautiful, dark-skinned black girl with dreadlocks and, like, all the black affirmations you could possibly need in the black community, people who look like that, who have been, you know, systematically marginalized. And that's just always been, like, the historical perspective, right? To have that in, and it's like, oh, but this white girl just put her elbow on the head of this black girl, and that was the picture of the ad, and it was just so heartbreaking. The key here is not to be defensive. The key is to be like, well, maybe she didn't have to put, like, it could have been innocent and it really could have, but what is the image to send down? Because you don't have time to explain that, oh, they're playful and they're friends in everyday life, that would happen, it's fine.
They should have been a bit more woke,
basically.
Do you want to explain very quickly what woke means? And we did Google it.
Oh, did you?
Would you like to clarify what it means?
So, my understanding of woke is an awakening, right? You awaken to the injustice and, like, you're aware that everything is not as it seems. And then the narrative is, like, once you've opened your eyes to those things, the unfairness of how Britain can just go bomb Syria and, like, we can't do nothing about it, like, and refuse to take refugees. Like, how dare you? You know what I mean? You can't do anything about it. And it's hard because, yeah, we can't physically change the situation now, but actually it's the continuum. It's us pushing and pushing and pushing eventually that is going to have a breakthrough, hopefully. And the objective is, once you have awakened, stay woke. Don't forget that, yes, you're not going to win the battle tomorrow or the day after. It's a process. So stay woke. Keep pushing.
Thank you so much. And that was really good coming from you as an activist on so many issues. I want to ask you one more thing, and that's about the medical disadvantages of chemically straightening. You touched on it a little bit, but I've never heard of any of these things. Can you tell me a bit more about what they are?
Right, okay. So there's issues where, like, physically your hair could fall out. So the process basically undoes the coils in your hair, which essentially means that it kills off your hair, because what happens is, isn't it that once you chemically straighten your hair, that's the end of it. You have to keep doing it when you have new growth. So basically killing off your hair as it grows and altering, like, the structure of it. And, like, the physical things is, like, you can get burned because it's, like, it's a chemical. People get burned, people get scars, people get sore, people's hair fall out.
You describing the hair as being relaxed, it just
it's
doesn't
not,
really throw
not
that picture.
Right, it's a big lie, right? It's a myth when they say relax. That's why I try to use, like, chemically straighten, because language is important as well, right?
Yeah.
We should say you're chemically altering the structure of your hair and basically killing it off. Because every time you have new growth, you have to relax it again to match the bit that you've already killed off. It's so insidious. People don't think about it. It's like, relax. It gives off the feeling like you're doing something good.
Chilling out.
It kind of makes it, like, easier to digest in a sense. Just kind of like, oh, I'm relaxing my hair. It doesn't really give the true meaning of what's
exactly
happening.
The power of language. Like, you use that term and nobody thinks that it's an epidemic that we need to look at. Nobody right. thinks that it's a serious issue that we're altering the structure of our hair. Right, if nobody, I'm going to recommend something now.
I'll go for
Chris
it.
Chris Rock, Good Hair documentary. I really love the documentary because I think for me, I didn't wake up overnight and was like, I'm not going to do it anymore. I think it was just a process of things that gradually happen. And I was like, oh, you know, maybe I shouldn't do this thing anymore because it doesn't really seem to be helping me that much, to be totally honest. And these things happen culturally. So basically, Chris Rock did this documentary because he has two girls and he's married to a woman, a black woman. And Chris Rock is a black man of African descent who has a family full of black women. And he's grown up all his life, watch us do these things to ourselves. Relaxing is far the word from it. Trust me, it is hell. It is pain. It is actual pain. And the worst thing is, when you've got this chemical in your hair and it's burning, and there's this notion of, oh, if I leave it a bit longer, it's going to make my hair, like, super, super straight. So you sit there in this pain for 5-10 minutes longer, just so when you wash it out, your hair can be super straight.
It's just fascinating.
It is. It really is. And it's a testament to how insidious white supremacy and racism is, really, isn't it? That you convince a group of people to essentially torture themselves to look more like
you. Physically inducing pain.
Exactly. Exactly.
And to have a job. The idea that that's like how hair should look for your job, that that's acceptable.
That's professional. I mean, I don't know if you've seen it, but like every now and then this conversation comes up when people screenshots it into Google when they're like, professional hair. And it's loads of white women, like blonde hair, like wavy, like, you know, in the ads. And then you Google unprofessional hair and it's literally tons, shit tons of black women.
Oh my gosh, I've never even tried that, but I'm afraid.
Shit tons of black women with their natural hair. It's not shit tons of black women with like weaves, like, and whatever it is, shit ton of black women with natural hair. Google needs to fix up.
What would you like to tell your younger self? Go back.
Wow.
Tell Barbara, maybe when you were around 14.
Yeah, one piece
right,
of advice.
Right, okay, when I was around 14, oh, this is going to sound like a really sub story. I was in the UK at that time, and I hated school. So I went to school in a town called Barnsley, and there's a insidious kind of nationalism, which saw, like, the BNP always in the town centre and stuff. And School was very hard for me as a black person. At one point, I was the only black person in my entire school. I mean, I was dealing with a lot of things at the time that my mum didn't understand, because she's of an older generation, and her approach has been, you know, yeah, people are racist, yeah, people don't like you, but you kind of just have to get on with it. But people think that I shouldn't exist. It's quite hard to get on with life when people think that you shouldn't exist, or that you're shit, or that you're that, and, you know, and that you're less than them, and that you're not human. It's actually really quite hard to get on with stuff. So if I could speak to my younger self, I'd be like, you know what? It's not as simple as just saying, oh, it's hard now, but it's going to get better, because it took a long time to get better. And that was because I said, well, fuck what you think. Like, do you know me? I exist. Fucking deal with it. And just basically understanding how race and racism work. Like I said, I was born in Ghana and I didn't have any concept of race. And I knew of white people and whiteness per se. And up until that point, my view of whiteness was very, it's different. It was just like, oh, it's just, oh, somebody just looks different from me, which is okay. But not understanding that that was the basis of which other people were going to treat me, because I didn't look like them. So if I could speak 40-year-old me, I'd be like, go to the library and check out a Malcolm X book and read it quicker, because you would have shut people down a lot quicker than you did. So it's probably what I'd say. Like,
do you think the idea behind that is the fault is not with you, it's with society?
Yes.
And like, so yes, you just keep being yourself, you keep being great.
Yes.
And you'll become more and more aware of it, but it's hard to become aware of it, because you have to actively look for it, research it, and find it.
Yeah,
it's not given to you in a textbook in history.
History was like the worst subject. I hate it.
So one last thing that I want to talk about is sassy teas.
Yes.
I want to touch on this and everything to do with that.
I'm from a working class family, single mum, and London is mad expensive. Just because I'm an anti-capitalist doesn't mean that like I shouldn't make money to live on. I need to think of a way that I can bring in my politics and do something with it. Yeah, sassy teas came along, and I was generally inspired by a lot of what I'd seen in America. The main ones I saw were just generally like reselling stuff to people who are interested in popular culture, which is fine. But I was like, well, I am interested. Like, I want to know what Beyonce wore to the Met Gala, which was fire, by the way. But I also want to know what's politically going on in the world. I want to know about the Black Lives Matter struggle. I want to, you know, read about people who contributed to me being physically in the space I'm in. Sassy teas was one. So sassy teas were super, super political. Unlike companies that don't like to have any political affiliations, we have one. And we're Team Jeremy, FYI. Yeah. I think my main target audience are black women. They're like my number one target people who buy stuff from me.
Can white people buy stuff from Sassy Teas?
Yes.
I was going to say, because there's a tote bag on there that I really want.
No, certainly white. So this is a question I actually asked myself, because it's like, who am I making this for? And it's like, well, I'm definitely making it for black women, because I'm a black woman. I'm making stuff that I would wear. And it's like, hold on a minute. But everybody can wear this if you ascribe to the politics. That's really what it is. The fact that a lot of the named people on my stuff are not white people is really important to me. But you can try to ascribe to the character and values of a non-white person as a white person. That is a fair thing to do. If you think that this person has the same politics as you, the only thing that's differentiating you right now is the social construct of race, to be honest. So yes, certainly white people can definitely buy my stuff. And we do have some very, you know, out there stuff, which I have to caution people sometimes, because people see in the street and they don't get it. So me and my friend had a conversation about a particular item on the website, which is carry yourself with the confidence of a mediocre white man.
That's the best.
That's the one we fucking love.
That's the one that we want.
Right, most people love this, and I love it too, and I, you know, I carried that bag around. But I was talking to one of my friends who is a black woman. She was like, I really like this bag and I would wear it, but if I were in certain situations, I will flip it around so people can read it, just because I feel like if somebody did not understand...
Well, it can be hard to see and recognise your own privilege. So if you don't understand, if you're not woke, I guess,
yeah,
then it doesn't make any sense. Like,
go on, Sid! I didn't have any issue and I wasn't aware of that. And my friend raised it, and I was like, and we had a very interesting conversation about it. And it's just obviously, there is a fear. I mean, like, we've seen people not wearing backs, and just generally, like, Muslim women and Muslim people being attacked and pushed in front of trains and stuff. Like, it's not very far-fetched to think that somebody would try and attack you for having an item like that. So But I think that's is part of the conversation. But some lady did stare at me for like ages, and she just kept rolling her eyes at me. And I really wished I had a spare one, because I would have given it to her and be like, girl, we're on the same side, okay?
So where can people find all of your stuff? What's the website link?
Right, the website is www.sassytees.co.uk. You can follow us on Twitter at @sassyteesuk. You can follow us on Instagram at @sassyteesuk.
Like t-shirts, tote bags with your t-shirt, slogans.
T-shirt, tote bags, the slogans on. Yes. We do some African head wraps. It's just like, I don't know, when I put a headscarf on, I'm like, yeah, I can take on the world. Come at me.
Thank you so much coming on. This has been amazing.
Yeah, thank you so much. You've been very badass.
It's fun. Shout out to Sid and Elena. Bra, bra, bra. Woo! Sid and Elena, stay woke.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.